coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A significant chunk of state workers could be eligible for overtime under President Obama's newly proposed OT guidelines. While state officials say it won't stress an already strained budget, others say that doesn't mean there won't be an impact.
Some employers get used to the notion with salaried workers that they can work people long hours for free.
Our political reporter James Dawson has that story. Growing up in her tough South Bronx neighborhood, Sonia Manzano sought refuge in television.
I tried to put things together about life through what I saw on television. I'm sure that that's informed my work and my desire to work with very young children.
We chat with the actress, best known as Maria on Sesame Street, ahead of her visit to UD next week. I'm your host, Tom Berm. We also look ahead to next week's Roadhouse Blues Fest in Magnolia, learn about the role climate change may play in managing fisheries, and take you to a unique women's boutique in Wilmington. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Berm. When President Obama proposed new federal overtime thresholds in June, his administration anticipated it could affect about 5 million people in the United States. If approved by the Department of Labor, those making under $50,400 a year would be eligible for extra pay if they work beyond their normal schedule. That's up from the current cutoff of about $24,000. In states like Delaware, where a significant chunk of the workforce is made up of public employees, that could strain an already overextended state budget, where the projected revenue shortfalls for next year range between $130 and $160 million, according to state officials. Delaware Public Media political reporter James Dawson crunched the first state numbers to see how this OT rules change could affect the state's payroll and more.
An analysis of 2014 state payroll data shows about 38% of full-time public workers in Delaware earn less than the proposed $50,400 annual salary mark, potentially making them eligible to collect overtime benefits. The situation becomes even starker if you exclude employees who are part of a union or already collect overtime, like state troopers or nurses. That number then climbs to 59% of full-time public workers, according to state records. Office of Management and Budget officials haven't looked yet at their own records to see what cost to the state, if any, these proposed regulations might have, according to its director, Ann Vasali.
I wouldn't commit to any analysis at this point until we get the final interpretation of the policy from the federal government.
Delaware Public Media's analysis shows nearly 12,000 state workers could start accruing overtime if Obama's proposal goes through unchanged. Despite that number, Vasali says it's unlikely that each of those employees would need to stay on the clock longer.
Who's eligible is one of the drivers, but also whether or not they regularly work overtime. So, you know, there are obviously maybe other exemptions.
Those exemptions come down to an individual employee's specific duties, including whether they manage other workers or mostly perform office work. Records show the state paid out $55.9 million in overtime last year, or about 3% of the total payroll. For example, nearly 1,000 state troopers earned some amount of overtime pay last year. Over half of them took home more than $10,000 in 2014, according to that data, with one earning nearly $100,000 in overtime. Vasali argues paying for those extra hours ultimately saves the state money.
Hiring a full-time employee is certainly more expensive, especially given our generous pension plan and health care, than overtime, much of which is driven on a temporary basis.
One of the most likely scenarios is that the state will simply not have employees work past a full week. That's according to Ross Eisenbray, vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, a union-backed think tank that supports Obama's proposal.
That was the fundamental purpose of the Fair Labor Standards Act, was to control excessive hours and to say the standard work week is 40 hours a week and we will have a disincentive for employers to work anyone longer than that. We'll make them pay extra.
And Joint Finance Committee Chair Senator Harris McDowell agrees. Right now, only those making under $23,600 are automatically eligible for overtime.
A lot of those white-collar workers would be eligible for food stamps and other benefits. And so the increase in pay would maybe, on one hand, would cost us, but on the other hand, would save us money.
Instead, McDowell says his bigger worry is that Delaware's stagnant wages will lead its workers to jump to the private sector.
I'm more concerned, frankly, about a brain drain on the state employee, not because of this change, but because of all those restrictions and austerity that we've placed upon our state employees.
In several speeches and presentations over the past year, Governor Jack Markell has repeatedly touted cuts he made to Delaware's public workforce since first taking office in 2009. During that time frame, Markell slashed about 1,000 state jobs. A recent report funded by the Business Roundtable, a group of Delaware CEOs, urges state lawmakers to trim the state's payroll even further through hiring freezes or eliminating positions altogether. But with those cuts, public employees, like many private sector workers in America, have had to shoulder more responsibilities for stagnating wages. According to a Pew Research Center report from 2014, average wages peaked nationwide in 1973, with inflation barely keeping pace or in some cases even falling. Markell has proposed a single 1% pay raise in his 7 years on the job, aside from restoring a salary cut he and state lawmakers made to help weather the 2009 recession. Eisenbray says under those circumstances, an exodus to the private sector like McDowell fears is understandable.
If the pay is really falling behind, you're more likely to jump. So it's going to be, it is already, and it's going to be a worse problem going forward for public agencies to retain good people.
Vassalli notes that, quote, there's nothing the governor would like more than to be able to provide regular pay increases, end quote, but points to another looming $130 million deficit for next year, this time for the cost of health benefits.
If we weren't facing the significant cost to the state for providing these health care benefits, many of which are way more generous than what you might face in other governmental entities and the private sector, there may be more funds freed up for other types of compensation increases like pay.
The U.S. Department of Labor is currently looking over the nearly 250,000 comments received before finalizing any potential changes to Obama's proposal. Eisenbray estimates that any revision would go into effect by the end of next summer based on past experience with similar federal rule changes. That timeline gives state officials short notice to adapt to any changes, with early budget presentations starting in November. James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James. And stay with us. An interview with Sonia Manzano, Maria from Sesame Street, is next. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. R is for retirement. After 44 years, Sonia Manzano is leaving Sesame Street. Best known for her role as Maria on the show, the actress not only entertained and educated kids, but wrote for Sesame Street as well, earning 15 Emmy Awards along the way. Manzano has just released a new memoir, and on Thursday, September 17th, the actress will speak at the University of Delaware. The free presentation is open to the public and part of UD's Latino Heritage Month celebration. This week, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter talked to Manzano, one of the most influential Latinas in television, about becoming a cultural trailblazer.
Sonia, many of your fans say this is an end of an era, but for you, it's the beginning of new endeavors. Your memoir, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx, and we very much look forward to your appearance here at the University of Delaware for Latino Heritage Month. You know, it's kind of easy to forget that when you started on Sesame Street back in 1971, it was very rare to see Latinos on national television.
Absolutely. I was raised in the South Bronx in the mid-50s, and I watched hours and hours of television and never saw anybody who looked like me or lived in the same kind of neighborhood that I lived in. And that was certainly disconcerting because you felt invisible and wondered how you were going to contribute to a society that seemed blind to you.
Can we speak a little bit more about the effects that might have on a child when they don't see themselves on TV, they don't see themselves reflected in the culture?
Well, we know that kids will obviously go to the obvious role model or the obvious image. That's why so many African-American boys go into sports. They think that's their only avenue because that's the most visible for them, or to be music celebrities because that's the other obvious image that we see in the media. You sort of start to circumscribe your own life or make your life a little bit smaller because you want to fit into the roles that are available to you.
Another thing that was unique about Maria was that she was one of the few TV females who were actually allowed to age on screen.
Yes, yes. Yes, that was the marvelous thing about Sesame Street, is they really wanted real people, always. And if you were going to be a real person, you'd have to really age, as real people do. You didn't have to maintain the ingenue status you had when you started the show.
So you started as a teenager, as your character, and then you later grew up, you got married on television, another Sesame Street milestone, and Maria
right.
went on to become a mom and a working woman.
Yes. I ran a lending library originally, then I was a feminist, and then I fell in love. And it was very important for the show to let the viewers see Hispanics having the same hopes and dreams as everybody else, wanting to fall in love, get married, have a child, and have that child be educated. At that time, Latinos were just the butt of jokes on television, and Sesame Street obviously did not want to do that.
I can imagine that you got many letters from young girls, and boys, perhaps.
Yes, yes, I did. I got wonderful, wonderful letters all along, letters from abroad also, because Sesame Street is seen in so many foreign countries. But I think that now, since my retirement, is when I'm really seeing the impact that I had on people. I'm not going to be falsely modest. I always knew that I had some impact. But the retirement has really inspired people to tell me very personal things about themselves, how they came from troubled homes, and Sesame Street was an hour of tranquility and calmness, and a way to get away from their chaotic lives. And that's gratifying to me, because I found comfort in television as well.
Well, and as you reveal in your memoir, not too dissimilar from your own upbringing in the South Bronx.
Yes, yes. I came from a tumultuous environment and childhood, and I found a lot of comfort on television. I tried to put things together. I tried to answer my questions about life through what I saw on television and what I saw out the window, other people, the things that other people did. And I'm sure that that's informed my work and my desire to work with very young children.
So with your retirement, now you have your memoir, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx, as we said. How long did it take you to get all of this together, and how was the writing process for you?
Oh, it took me forever. I have drafts in my closet, I think, that have 1995 on them, if you can believe that. It took a long time to find the voice, to find where I was going to end it, whether it was going to go through my Sesame Street years. I think finding the voice, finding the tone was the hardest part. I was inspired by Frank McCourt, Angela's Ashes, that wonderful book where he describes the most miserable childhood you could possibly imagine, yet it's hilariously funny as well. And I thought, I can do that. I have a sense of humor, and my childhood was trying as well. So he was a great inspiration. And I came late to writing. I started writing on Sesame Street, writing scenes for the show because I knew the characters, and there were comedic scenes, but it wasn't prose. So I started writing for the show, and as the show shot less and less programs and the cast expanded more and more, I found myself with a lot of creative energy and some free time on my hands. And that also gave me the impetus to write.
And Sonia, you also wrote your first young adult novel a couple of years ago, The Revolution of Evelyn Serrano, which examines the Latino community during the Civil Rights Movement through the eyes of a young girl living in Spanish Harlem.
Right. That book takes place in 1969 when, of course, as many people know, the whole country was in upheaval. It was the Civil Rights Movement and the moon landing and President Johnson was going to create a great society, and it was a very idealistic time in America, and actually 1969 was the year that Sesame Street first aired, and everybody had a political platform, except Latins, and the Young Lords were a group of young people who decided to take a stand in Spanish Harlem. They fashioned themselves first after the Black Panthers and then kind of went their own way, and they decided to make a political stand. And so the revolution of Evelyn Serrano is this young girl observing this going on in her neighborhood and trying to figure out where she stands in this, being in the middle of this revolutionary fervor, because she is caught between a traditional mother and a revolutionary grandmother. It was great. I did a lot of research on what was going on in 69.
It sounds like it was a fun project. And when you come to the University of Delaware, I imagine we're going to get to hear stories like this about your life.
Yes, I did not align myself with the Young Lords, frankly, because I wasn't that politically motivated at that time. I wanted to write jokes, and I wanted to be in the theater, and I didn't see how the two could blend, because actually a wonderful poet who wrote humorous poetry, but was also very political, his name was Pedro Pietri. I read his poetry, and I said, wow, you can be political and funny at the same time. And so I look forward to talking about that to the students at the Delaware University.
Well, Sonia, a TV pioneer, we are so grateful that you took the time out to tell us some of your stories here on Delaware Public Media, and just give us a little taste of it so we can get folks to the University of Delaware to hear more.
I do. I hope they come, and I can tell them all about my Christmas book also. I have a picture book being released the end of September, and it's called The Miracle on 133rd Street. And like everything else, it takes place in the Bronx.
And, of course, all about Big Bird and Cookie Monster.
And all about Big Bird and things they never knew, like what made Maria fall in love with Luis on Sesame Street.
Our thanks to Sonia Manzano for her time. Her new memoir is Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. The actress will be signing books following her free talk at UD next Thursday night at 7 at the Trabant University Center. The Green continues in a few moments with a look at what role climate change could play in managing the region's fisheries going forward. But first, the latest news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Late last month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released a sweeping plan to start factoring climate change into how it manages American fisheries. NOAA's five-year climate science strategy covers how warming oceans and other changes are affecting marine resources coast to coast in ways most fishermen and regulators are already seeing. And the plan proposes ways to quantify those impacts as part of how fish stocks are managed year to year. But some think that'll be easier said than done. Richard Wong is a biometrician with the State Division of Fish and Wildlife who works on high-value fisheries like blue crab and black sea bass. He talked with our Annie Ropeek about the changes he's seen in the last 15 years on the job and why he feels regulating based on climate change could be a challenge.
So you mentioned before we got on the phone about some of the big changes you've seen just in population distribution and kind of what these fish stocks are doing. Can you tell me a little bit about that, sort of summarize what the big changes have been that you've seen?
Personally, I think it's amazing to see the scope, the size of the changes that are occurring on a coast-wide scale. Well, many of the fish populations that we manage have been moving northward. Summer flounder, black sea bass, we've seen that. And really what's more amazing is the speed at which it has occurred. This has all happened within a decade, which is really striking. I mean, some of these populations have been more uniformly distributed along the eastern seaboard for a lifetime. You know, the obvious smoking gun is, of course, the global climate change or temperature rise, we think.
Can you talk about how those sorts of changes impact fishermen and how their sort of business works?
So when fish populations move, obviously it affects the fishermen. For example, in Delaware, we've pretty much enjoyed a summer flounder recreational fishery for many, many years. But just in the past 10 years, those fish have moved seemingly have moved up north into more closer into the New York, New Jersey area and northwards. So our anglers have very, you know, limited access, at least historically speaking, to these fish. And wherever these fish are leaving, obviously the commercial fisheries certainly suffer. Whereas, you know, where it's a negative, perhaps down here in Maryland and Virginia, it's a positive certainly for states like Massachusetts, where those fisheries now have access to some colder water species, like, for example, summer flounder and black sea bass.
You've mentioned a lot of different data points that are, it sounds like, are being collected as part of fisheries management right now. Do you feel like these things are being sort of incorporated into how you do your stock assessments, things like that, the right way, and how could that be improved?
As fisheries managers, we definitely acknowledge that something is happening. Some large process is occurring here that are affecting fish distributions. We do not currently fold into our assessment process the temperature rise. It's very difficult to do that and try to it's very difficult to predict how it's going to continue to affect the distributions and abundance of our temperate species here.
Yeah, I guess what would that even look like to sort of incorporate the idea or the acknowledgement of warming into your actual, you know, kind of day-to-day work? Is that possible?
I'm sure it will be attempted in the future, certainly since NOAA has implemented this climate change strategy. I don't know how they're going to do that. I don't know how we're going to fold that into our models. We manage in on a year-to-year basis. We try to anticipate changes that might occur next year or 2 years. So we don't typically we don't do a good job of looking at population changes over decades, for example. It's just too difficult to do. So I can't see it being a tool for us yet to try to incorporate our predictions about climate change. Fisheries management is more of a short-term management approach, 1 or 2 years ahead.
So as far as NOAA's kind of 5-year plan here, they definitely talk a lot about working at a regional level with, you know, partners like folks like DENREC and, you know, the councils and things like that about putting some of these actions into place and developing them. What would you like to see, I mean, out of more collaboration with the feds in this area? Do you feel like there are, you know, real priorities that you'd like some help on, or what do you think you'd want to get out of that on the Delaware level?
Well, the federal fisheries management has to adapt to these distribution shifts, certainly. Many of the federal species are managed by quota, and the quotas are allocated by state. So as these populations, as the abundances change, you know, from south to north, obviously the allocations have to change from south to north as well. We expect that to happen. That's one consequence, that we expect to see at the federal level of fisheries management. I mean, I don't know how to brace for this here in Delaware, or what we want from the federal, our federal counterparts. Certainly more research to be conducted. But it's not for fisheries management. We're dealing with trying to predict changes in a living resource. Whereas, you know, you could, for example, bracing for the impacts of climate change is much more straightforward when you're talking about trying to protect property or protect against storms. You know, protect the beach from erosion or bracing for sea level rise for homeowners, for example. But for managing how living resources are going to adapt to the climate change is much more difficult.
That's a really interesting point, that it's a living resource and it's not just, it's, you know, human activity that stays the same as the climate changes around it. a much more dynamic situation. That's a really interesting point.
Because a lot of other factors are affecting how populations change other than climate change. You know, how much fishing effort is occurring, and other sources of natural mortality like predation or disease also affect the population dynamics. So it's very difficult to add in another component, you know, like rising sea temperatures. It's very difficult to incorporate that into an already uncertain mixture of elements that affect how populations change through time. This is a really difficult topic for us to comment on because it's a huge issue, obviously. On a gigantic scale. It's a global phenomenon. And fisheries management is pretty difficult to begin with before you start factoring into it to climate change. So we have to, unfortunately, be a little bit reactive as fisheries managers just because it's so difficult to model population changes to begin with.
Our thanks to Denrek Fisheries biometrician Rich Wong for his insights on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's 5-year plan to better incorporate climate change into fisheries management. You can find a link to NOAA's plan at DelawarePublic.org. And next up on The Green, it's our arts playlist and a look ahead to the Central Delaware Blues Society's upcoming Roadhouse Blues Fest. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Central Delaware Blues Society, formed several years ago to grow and promote the blues in Kent and Sussex counties, hosts a weekly Thursday night jam session at Jonathan's Landing in Magnolia, and has also brought national blues acts to the state to perform. Next weekend, September 18th and 19th, the Society presents its second annual Roadhouse Blues Fest at Jonathan's Landing. In our arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter gets a preview with the group's president, Barry Pugh, and musician Joey Fulkerson.
Barry Pugh, president of the Central Delaware Blues Society. How has the reception been by folks? Do you get a lot of folks coming to these events that you have?
Yes, we do. The summertime, we get a fairly good attendance, but as the weather starts to turn a little cooler, we get more people in. We get anywhere from 50 to, I'm going to say, 125 people that show at the shows. And we expect that to grow as our popularity gets better and bigger.
With us as well, musician Joey Fulkerson. You're a big blues aficionado. How is the temperature for that kind of music here in Central Delaware?
It's actually really, really good. The great thing about it is we found a place to play now. It used to have, you used to have to travel around. If you wanted to see a national act, you had to go to at least Wilmington or Annapolis or Baltimore or D.C., but now all these great acts are coming right. I mean, I live 2 miles from there. It's awesome for me. And just everybody that lives around here, it's a great thing. You don't really get to see that caliber of musician coming through. And another thing, they have the jam. When there's not shows, there's a jam on Thursdays. And it's pretty incredible the talent that is around here that just shows up on a Thursday night to play.
So you're a fan and a musician.
I'm a big fan, yeah. I went to the Ball and Cork the other night and was standing out there watching Buddy Guy on my night off and, just turn right around and go play the next night with that kind of fire, It's a lot of fun. So.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about your own career.
Oh, I've been playing music since I was 14. Started playing for money around 17. Ended up in a lot of different kind of bands, getting my musical education, an old funk band, and I played in an oldies band, and eventually ended up getting a job with Chubby Checker. I toured with Chubby Checker for 6 years, went all around the world, and when that job ended, I just came back home and kind of had an idea what I wanted to do and the guys I wanted to play with, so we put Nothing But Trouble together, and it's been pretty good ever since. So.
And Nothing But Trouble, one of the bands playing the Roadhouse Blues Fest on Friday, September 18th.
That's correct.
You've been good enough to bring your guitar.
I brought a guitar.
You're going to do a song for us.
Sure.
The rest of the band aren't here, but we're going to hear a great unplugged version by Joey Fulkerson of Nothing But Trouble. What are you going to do for us?
This is an old Elmore James song. It's called Dust My Broom. Thank you.
gonna get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my broom. I'm gonna get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my broom. So that gal that I've been loving and my friend could have my room. I'm gonna write a letter, send it every town I know. I'm gonna write a letter, send it every town I know. If that girl ain't over in China, baby, she may be in Dover, don't you know? I believe my time ain't long. Yeah, that gal that I was loving, she broke up my happy home.
And that's Joey Fulkerson of the band Nothing But Trouble playing the Roadhouse Blues Fest, presented by the Central Delaware Blues Society. It's coming up at Jonathan's Landing in Magnolia. It's Friday, September 18th and Saturday, September 19th. Joey, you said you played with Chubby Checker.
Yes.
Tell us something about Chubby Checker we've never heard before.
Gosh. He lives in Paoli, Pennsylvania, and he still lives in the same house he bought when he first got his money, when he first recorded. He bought a property there and basically just developed it and stayed right there in the neighborhood, and everything grew up around him.
But you were able to travel the world.
I was.
What are some of the places that you were able to go to?
Well, we played every state in the United States, including Alaska and Hawaii. Went all through Canada. I went to Ireland. I went to Australia, Mexico. It was not the dream job as a musician, you know, because you kind of play the same stuff every night. You know, I know how to play the twist really good now. And I would have never got to do that if I, you know, wasn't playing guitar.
So. Sure. But now you're back home in Delaware.
I am.
With your band, Nothing But Trouble. Can you play us another song?
I can.
That'd be great. What are you going to do for us now?
This is an original song. This is on our second CD.
Girl, you're off of someone new, and you're gone, gone, gone. You don't love me no more. You don't feel it in your soul. Well, I guess you have to roll, 'cause you're gone, gone, gone. You left me, baby, without a word, just like I knew you would. Came home last night and found your things were gone. Oh no, this can't be good. You don't love me no more. You don't feel it in your heart. Girl, that's why the teardrops start. And you're gone, gone, gone. Without a word, just like I knew you would. Came home home last night and found your things were gone. Oh no, this can't be good. You don't love me no more. You don't feel it in your soul. Well, I guess you had to go, 'cause you're gone, gone, gone. You don't love me no more. You don't feel the way I feel. Girl, I finally know your deal, and you're gone, gone, gone. Yeah, you're gone, gone, gone. Yeah, you're gone, gone, gone. Yeah, you're gone, gone, gone.
Joey Fulkerson of the band Nothing But Trouble, playing Friday, September 18th, and Barry Pugh, the president of the Central Delaware Blues Society. This is your second annual Summer Music Fest. How was last year's?
We had estimated 250 people attended. It was a Monday event. It was a Saturday event. So this year we've decided to extend it out to a Friday night and a Saturday, and we've added another act this year. So we're pretty happy with the results of it last year, and we're hoping this year is going to be the at least as good or better.
Just bigger and better, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Joey, again, you're playing Friday night. I imagine that the musicians around here are pretty tight.
Yes, great bunch of guys and great players and good friends, actually. Yeah.
And I imagine a good fan base, but we're always looking for more, right?
Always need more, yeah. That's a great thing about the Central Delaware Blues Society is actually drawing people who don't play. They just enjoy the music. And the great thing about their setup there is, too, is it's really focused on the music. There's no TVs in the room, no sports going on, anything like that. When you come in there, you're expecting to be entertained, and you usually get entertained. It's pretty a lot of fun.
Our thanks to Central Delaware Blues Society President Barry Pugh and musician Joey Fulkerson. The Roadhouse Blues Fest is Friday, September 18th and Saturday, September 19th at Jonathan's Landing in Magnolia. Ticket information is available at centraldelawareblues.com. Stay with us. Enlighten Me takes us shopping at a unique boutique in Wilmington. Next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. It can be a struggle for women to find clothes for the office that both fit and flatter them. And that's a vacuum the Wilmington boutique Entree Donovan aims to fill. The store won a Best of Delaware award this summer, and in this week's Enlighten Me, our Ann Hoffman sets out to discover why the boutique is generating so much buzz.
Linda Farquhar, the owner of Entree Donovan, is giving me the full treatment today. When I arrived, she put out a bowl of almonds and offered me fresh coffee. This is the closest thing to a French fashion house or salon I've ever seen, but we're not anywhere near the Seine. We're in downtown Wilmington, across the street from a Starbucks.
When you come into the shop, normally you would have an appointment. And you would be planning to spend about an hour here. When you first come in, we'll greet you and, you know, have you set down your handbag or whatever, sit down at the table here where it's nice and comfortable, and then we'll go through some of your preferences, your dress code, what your lifestyle is, so we can get an understanding of how you want to dress, how you want to convey yourself.
Linda is kind of like a style therapist for women who need good office clothing. And like any good therapist, she has her work cut out for her. The business world is notoriously difficult to dress for, and the term business casual doesn't exactly inspire. I tell Linda that at 29, I'm dressing too young. It's really about what I can afford, but also about my work conditions. There are days when I have to report in 90-degree weather. And I do feel sort of rebellious about having to wear clothes that aren't very practical. And Linda challenges me.
What you're wearing, even though it seems superficial, is actually like so important in the way people are going to interact with you.
I get the sense she does that a lot, and it's for the client's own good.
If you're in journalism, and there's a crowd of journalists, and you're trying to get recognized in the crowd, so President Obama points to you to answer, you know, to ask the question, then you need to stand out somehow. He needs to think that you're credible, you're gonna, you know, you're like very good at what you do. And how else can he judge that? He's not reading every bio of every press person in the audience.
And another thing Linda told me, people form first impressions in less than half a second. And here's where things get more complicated. Even for women who are intentional about wearing well-assembled business outfits, a lot of times they still don't look that good.
Here's the latest look from Paris, filmed in Paris. Flattering new creations by Dior, Balmain, Lanvin, and other top...
In the old days, clothing was made for a woman's specific body, which for obvious reasons just looks better. Even middle-class women had dressmakers, Linda tells me. And for wealthy women, going to get clothes made was luxurious and intimate. But then came the rise of off-the-rack.
Most of our clients would no more buy a garment off a rack than jump off a cliff. It would spell the end of haute couture and good taste.
That's a clip from an Australian miniseries about a 1920s lady detective called Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. Miss Fisher has a reputation for being kind of a fashionista. In this scene, she's just solved a case for an exclusive designer who owns a salon. You just heard her in the tape.
Then I have a confession to make. I like to wear well-cut trousers. What's more, I have been known to buy clothing in department stores. But I will always love the glamour and attention of Salon Fleuri.
And that's Miss Fisher herself. At the time, women were beginning to have more options, and of course, buying in the dreaded department store was cheaper. But Miss Fisher's position suggests a balance. Women should buy nice clothing at the fashion house and everyday wear off the rack. But of course, that balance never really happened for most women. And the results of buying off the rack are that women aren't really wearing the right size clothing.
There was a size survey that was done by Size USA a while ago. They surveyed about 6,700 women, and they were trying to determine of those women what percentage of them fit into standard sizes, sizes 2 to 20 off the rack. So if they took by waist and hip, those two dimensions, only 15% of the women actually fit into off-the-rack sizing. And if they took bust, waist, and hip, it was less than 5% who fit.
Since Linda does things the old way, she's taking my specific measurements, but she's not using a tape measurer.
Now you're going to step your feet about a foot apart.
Instead, Linda asks me to stand on a rotating disc while a scanner takes my exact size. Linda's shop is the only one in the country to use this scanner. She even beta tested it for the company. It doesn't cost the client anything.
Kind of hair's a little bit down, so we might give you this so we can get it off of your neck.
I can't have one stray hair or any jewelry on, or the scan will be ruined.
Okay, so here's your scan.
Cool.
So you have a 3D image of you, and these lines in here are the points of measurement that we've defined.
To get a better sense of the clothing I'd actually wear, Linda asks me if there's a celebrity or fashion designer I like. I tell her I love an Australian designer named Yasmin Sewell. Linda pulls up some pictures of her on an iPad. Yasmin is wearing well-cut clothes, sometimes oversized, often with bold colors. Sometimes her outfits mix the slightly boyish with the ultra femme.
So in this sense, looking at her, she's conveying a very powerful image. I mean, if you see her in a crowd, she stands out.
It's not long before we get back into fashion therapy.
What is it that you connect with the most?
I think she sort of balances like the androgynous with the feminine in a way that really flatters her, mm-hmm. and also just looks like, I think an issue that I have being like, I'm a woman, but I don't want to scare you, but I don't want you to write me off just because I'm a woman. And mm-hmm. I feel like her clothes are very like fierce in a way.
Mm-hmm. I totally see what you mean. So this goes to your point where you want to be a bit of a...
Looking back on it, I get the sense that Linda hears a lot of confessions like these. Her store is warm, and she takes the time. Linda's asking women to open up about something they don't get to open up about a lot. Not just their bodies and their taste, but what it's like for them to navigate the work world, which, let's be honest, has never been an equal playing field.
So here I have a couple of swatch books.
It's time to pick out the fabric I'd choose for my custom-made pair of pants. Linda suggests an all-season wool, which actually breathes, even in 90-degree weather. Having expensive taste, I of course choose the couture fit instead of the business one. When all is said and done, the high-quality wool, the expert measurements, and the custom construction would cost me just shy of $500, which I simply can't shell out at the moment. But that's sort of not the point, because I leave the store feeling seen, and Linda's gently given me a sense of how the world sees me. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Ann Hoffman.
Thanks, Ann, for enlightening us this week. Entree Donovan has appointment availability for new clients, and it also offers a special e-style consultation with a list of recommended styles for $100. And that's all for The Green this week. As always, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We also want to hear from you. Give us your feedback on today's show and story ideas for future shows on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, James Dawson, Ann Hoffman, and Annie Ropeek, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks so much for joining us on The Green this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.